Was that about the Chinese accent?
Oh, I think the Chinese accent is good to have. If you, if you're, you know, equal to anybody and you have a Chinese accent, I think you can use it to your benefit. It's like an extra plus, because they recognize you, and they'll know you're Chinese anyway. I mean, when they see you, they'll know you're Chinese. And to have a Chinese accent, I don't think it's detrimental. In the old days, it used to be.
How was it detrimental in the old days?
In the old days, if you had an accent, they wouldn't hire you.
The white community.
The white community wouldn't hire you, wouldn't let you talk to other clients because you have this Chinese accent. They don't want to be known as architectural office with a Chinese accent, you know, because it's a Caucasian office to begin with. So they kind of, you know, limit you to the area of work that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you can professionally perform and all, they still looked at that as a speech impediment or whatever. And my brother used to tell me that that was some of the hidden ground rules, that you don't send a Chinese out to represent your firm. And you don't send, you know, a Chinese out to talk on the phone because he speaks like a Chinese.
And but you were saying, whereas in Chinatown, you would purposely put on an accent, right?
Yes.
In speaking English.
Right.
Why was that necessary?
Well, the American people come to Chinatown to be entertained, really. They come to Chinatown to buy things that are Chinese. And they almost expect you to have a Chinese deflect, you know, you have to speak with a Chinese sing-song.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost expect this. So some of them are great actors. They put it on, you know, you put it on thick.
Mm-hmm.
And just to please, you know, just to please the customer, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really unnecessary. But, well, I guess it's part of the Chinese flavor when you go to Chinatown. Well, let's go to Chinatown and go talk to these people. And
mm-hmm.
And but if you speak Chinese a lot, you will pick up that accent anyway.
How welcome were whites made to feel whenever they went into Chinatown in the earlier days? Or how were they viewed
in
by
the stores?
Chinese?
In the stores that catered to Chinese, they weren't very welcome. They would ask, what do you want? You know, I mean, a very crude, they don't say, how are you, or can I help you? They never say that.
They didn't care about the business?
No. The business was internal. They were only serving Chinese. Chinatown was serving Chinese. It wasn't serving the outside market. The restaurants, see, a lot of the Chinese used to eat, like, at our store, where there was no women. Are cooked for a man, and a lot of time my father would have contract with a restaurant to service for 30 days, you know, buy, just like buying a meal ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And every evening at dinner time we go to the restaurant to eat. My father pays a 30-month restaurant bill. And the Chinese have these what we call, they're for bachelors and for men that can't cook.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why a lot of the restaurants in Chinatown was developed. And like I say, every family had their own restaurant because their last name is Mok or Wong. You go to that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you a discount. You know, mm-hmm. It's to serve. It's so that they could do their bread and butter business. And then on top of that, the tourist business. And the tourist business, in restaurants, the Chinese are very gracious to the outside customers.
Mm-hmm.
In the curio stores, they're pretty nice. Like Ming's and their families, when you see an American come in, they always say, how are you, can I serve you? And they're very nice. You go into an all Chinese speaking store, they got no time to speak to you in English.
Mm-hmm.
It's strictly a Chinese for the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
You go to an herb store, they don't speak English. There was an herb store in there that was also from our village. And you go in there, they're always playing mahjong and they're always drinking tea. Nobody even gets up off their chair to say to the American, what do you want? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you could stand there until it freezes over. And I would say, gee, there's a, you know, customer. Oh, he's all right. If you want something, he can speak up. You know, they don't condone the fact that he's a customer. They just say, well, if you want something, you can speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of time, they don't want to do business with them. The guy comes out and says, I don't understand what you want. Yeah, go down and see Mr. choy or something. In other words, they'll pass you on. They don't really try to be helpful. Mm-hmm. In the old days, it was Caucasians weren't very friendly to the Chinese, and in return, the Chinese were never friendly to the outside market.
Mm-hmm.
Only the stores, gift shops, and all, they were real nice, because that's the only way they could do business.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Chinese, strictly for Chinese, no, they didn't. They didn't have to bend over backwards to serve you. A lot of the waiters, if they didn't feel right, they didn't give you any service at all. They just, yeah, you're just another customer. And what do you know? You know, they didn't go out of the way to be professional restaurant people until they went to New Chinatown. The first all super service, what an American thinks a restaurant should be, was Manchan or General Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Walter did the first, what I call, all-American Chinese restaurant. The place was done in gold leaf. The art was in antique Chinese.
Uh-huh.
There were potted plants.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Chinese waiters wore Mandarin jackets to make the Caucasian feel great, like they're going in some big high-powered restaurant. Their napkins were all colorful, their tablecloth was very well set, the crystal water glass, the silverware, the dishes were all extremely presentable.
Mm.
Typical of anything you find in the outside of Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter, being a gracious person, he was the best maitre d', he gave you the best side of him, he never showed any anxiety, he was just a perfect host. He would lead you into the bar and buy you a drink. And in other words, he gave you the typical all-American approach, but in a Chinese atmosphere. In return, he won the Gourmet's Award and the Holiday Cuisine Award,
mm-hmm,
for being a very elegant host and for servicing the American market with very elegant Chinese cooking and decor. And he won it for, I guess, 4, 5, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in Chinatown was envious of him. But he was the first to pick up on this being a gracious Chinese host. And he was the first to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Chinatown restaurants, they used to be envious of him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he did make a lot of money, and all his customers were all Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
They in turn picked up all the small Chinese group. So Walter is the first that I know of the Chinese restaurant that broke out of that all-Chinese-y type restaurant into an American Chinese, where they picked up all the Japanese customers, all the Japanese banquets, like 500 people, 300 people, 1,000 people,
mm-hmm,
all their wedding banquets and everything. The Japanese went to nothing but to Walter's place.
Mm-hmm.
They did a tremendous amount of banqueting.
Mm-hmm.
To the outside market,
mm-hmm,
which is where all the money is. Because here's 2 million Americans, and here's a very small Chinese population. And you're trying to be all Chinese in Chinatown, you really lost the point of where the real money is and where,
mm-hmm,
the profit is. Well, Walter and his wife and family, they all went in and catered after the American market. And this was way back in the 50s,
mm-hmm,
50s, 60s, they,
mm-hmm,
were doing it. And they did terrific business. They picked up all the nice, rich Caucasian people. And,
mm-hmm,
and when I take a customer, one of my clients, Caucasian client, which all ours are mostly Caucasian, I take them to Walter because they serve us like they do in an outside American restaurant. They're gracious. They come and serve cocktails. They make sure your wine is well done. They come back and ask if their food is done right, is it hot,
mm-hmm,
do you like the flavor, and where are you from. In other words, it gives you the standard all-American approach,
mm-hmm,
without the sing-song Chinese and all the rest. And the waiters are excellent.
Uh-huh.
They're very well trained, they're old, they're all men. And so I take that as not just to change to be an all-American Chinese restaurant, but I take that as being in the mainstream of knowing how to serve people to get the best advantage. And again, to teach the outside market how elegant a Chinese restaurant can be.
Mm-hmm.
Where the others are not trying to be elegant, he's trying to be elegant and trying to show to the outside market that the Chinese are not just stereotype restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
This is a contribution that I think Walter and his brothers, and being the first oldest Chinese restaurant, has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we got a lot of elegant Chinese from the mainland that really know how to serve Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in there. They're over in Beverly Hills and West LA, and they're serving Sweat Chin and Northern Chinese food. They're doing it. I think they're breaking the barrier even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And charging equally as high as the American market.
Right.
And I think this is all part of the whole expanding Chinese circle of influence, I think. And with us, like, when we take a client to, you know, dinner, we serve Chinese, we take them to a Chinese restaurant because, not because I'm Chinese, and not just that, but I think that the Chinese cuisine is probably the best in the world. You can't louse up a Chinese dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You might wreck one dish, but if you pick the Chinese restaurant, you can serve probably the best Chinese dinner ever offered to a Caucasian person, or anybody who's not Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that, well, my background's Chinese, and I'm not just selling Chinese. I think what I'm doing is that they're helping me please my client.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to start off in the right sense. And we feel that's important. And if they've never had Chinese food, it's a way of introducing Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way it is. I have a practice in Idaho as well. I have a license in Nevada, and I have a license in Texas, and I have a license in Idaho. And I have the first Chinese license in the state of Idaho. I didn't know that.
Oh,
I was uh-huh. kind of a shock. It was kind of hard to get in.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know this, and I didn't know why it was so difficult to get in. And it turned out that when I did get the license, I was told flat out by the Caucasian people that you're the first Oriental architect.
And when was that?
Oh, about 5 years ago. Let's see, my registration is it was 72. It's actually 8 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know that that was one of the conditions. But up there, when I take people out to dinner, I try to find a Chinese restaurant up there. Sometimes I can't, so I cook them a Chinese dinner, which is quite interesting because they like Orientals up in Idaho, most preferably Japanese, because the Japanese up there are very strong farmers. Very big, wealthy farmers up there in Idaho, and their contribution to the economy in Idaho is very good, and they have a lot of Japanese restaurants that are owned by Japanese, but they cook Chinese food,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In anywhere in the western United States, you can almost for sure find a Chinese restaurant. It's really interesting. I drive up to Montana, places that you can never... You would wonder, why would there be a Chinese? And boy, you find a Chinese restaurant.
Right.
It's really, really, well, isn't that strange? You wonder what motivates them to go that far. Like, we had a project up in Lewiston, Idaho. And up there, during the 1848, there was as much as over 10,000 Chinese gold miners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the northern tip of the Idaho state. There's a large Chinese cemetery up there. There's a Buddhist temple up there. A lot of Chinese artifacts in the mining camps. A lot of things that are leftover remains of Chinese doings,
mm-hmm.
like walls and things, you know, stone walls.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stone walls that the Chinese gold miners made, and they're still there.
Mm.
And the thing is, the Chinese in all the northern part of the states have never been accepted by the white people. With mining or anything like that. They never lived in the main part of the cities. They were always pushed out to the outside. They were always unwanted, you know. They were never accepted. And this is something that, well, at least where I grew up, my father said, if they don't want you, you don't fight your way in. You don't ever push your way. You have to prove your acceptance by working your way up. And I think it's always that way. I don't think, maybe now it's not so difficult, but in those days, you had to always prove that you're better than they are, or as good as they are. Just being good as they are, they won't accept you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go in and say, here I am, you lucky people, I'm Chinese, you know. That's not acceptable either. I mean, that's the last thing.
It's not gonna get you very far.
Yeah, it'll throw you out, if anything. And you can't always say you're the best either. If you do go in and say that, then they look at you for make mistakes. And the first time they see a mistake, they'll let you know you made a mistake. You're in that society, and it's very unfortunate that you have to do that, but I think we've passed over that now. I think we've proven all the things we need to prove. Now it's just getting on with getting into the mainstream, because in schools, like in colleges and stuff, in scholarships, all Chinese and Japanese are what you call the gray-white area. You're not black and you're not brown.
Mm.
And yellow is not acceptable as a minority, because you're too smart, number one, you're too intelligent, number two, and you don't act like a black and you don't act like a brown, and you're not intelligently a minority.
Mm.
Your intelligence is much higher. You're always getting the better grades, even though your family don't have a garden, or you don't have the atmosphere to. You're living in a ghetto, and yet you come out with better grades. It's accepted that you're not a minority, and yet you're not white. When you go for scholarships and grants, they tell you that you're a minority, but you're not a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you're unentitled to get a scholarship or a grant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that way around here.
In your earlier days, did you consider yourself Chinese or American or Chinese-American? Chinese? Uh-huh.
I mean, Chinese-American only in that American in that I was born here. That's about all.
Uh-huh.
And all my friends used to tell me that if you want to get anywhere in this world, you can't. You have to fight your way up. You have to prove your way all the time. You have to prove it. And a lot of them don't want to prove it. A lot of my friends didn't want to prove all the time that they're better than the others or whatever. And then yet they always say, gee, I'm Chinese, they never give me an opportunity, they never let me try, they never give me a job. And I found that that's wrong too. You can't cry and you can't scream and cry for unfairness if you haven't really tried. And some of them say, well, I tried for a whole year and I couldn't get an opportunity. Well, try 2 years. Who said a year was the minimum time that you fail and you can't get ahead? My brother tried for 3 years before he got a job.
Mm-hmm.
God, 3 years would have killed anybody's incentive.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just stubborn enough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that trying is just exactly what it is. You have to try. And being Chinese don't give you 1% better advantage of being hired. It might, because another Chinese will hire you,
mm-hmm.
but not in the case of the Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many of my friends that said, I'm afraid to go interview for a job because I don't know what to say. Well, look at the other way. A Caucasian person don't know what to say either when he goes in. He's just as scared as you are. And it's a 50-50 break. But then after 3 or 4 or 5 turndowns, they say, gee, I don't want to try anymore. It's disillusioning to go in and say, after you go through the whole interview, and they say, no, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. Then he gets mad.
Mm.
And I said, well, try somewhere else. Try another avenue. Try. But a lot of them say, well, my mother and father said, why don't we just go and do work in a Chinese restaurant or come back to the Chinese store. It's a lot easier. True, it is a lot easier. But we may have lost the Chinese in the outside market, because he may have been one of the brighter people in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And because he gave up too soon, we might have also lost somebody that was very good in the field. We might have opened up doors. But the lifestyle now is not so questioning of your ability or who you are in the job market. In fact, I think as an Oriental, you'll get a job before a black or a brown. In the black market, I have friends who are Negro architects. They still can't get jobs in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would hire them to do a house. Nobody would hire them to do an office building because they're black. And I don't know if it's because they're black or because the clientele will not hire them, or they're incompetent or feel they're incompetent and not superior. They'll hire a Mexican before they'll hire a black.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hire an Oriental way before they'll hire a black or a brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's fair, because I think they're doing the same, they're going through the same swimming upstream like the way the Chinese did back in the 30s. And it's only because we've had a lot of Chinese and Japanese sacrifice taking a lower cut in pay and doing more competent work and sacrificing in that sense, so that the next generation is coming up, that the owner says, oh gee, you know, that last guy that worked for me was Chinese and he was really conscientious.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me more than, you know, I gave him in pay.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he would in turn hire another Chinese and Japanese. And I think that because of that, we all had a chance to at least break the barrier down to where now any Chinese and Japanese can get a job in an architect's office or an engineering office without hesitation. I think we've opened the doors way up in that sector. We can probably, there'll be more Orientals hired before a Caucasian would be hired if your talent is in the same equal standards.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, the reason for being proud of being Chinese is the fact that in Chinatown, you were in your own little fortress.
Mm-hmm.
You could retreat and everybody likes you.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody roots for you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're a bad guy, they root for you. You know, they all watch out. If you get into trouble in Chinatown, or somebody would beat you up, some Chinese would pick up a phone and call your dad and mom and say, hey, somebody down there in the block is beating up on your son. The news gets around in Chinatown real fast. In fact, rumors in Chinatown in less than 4 hours would be a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
I could never figure that out. They have a grapevine which is better than any telephone system I've ever seen. My father one time bought a car, to show you how effective, he bought a car out of town in Calexico. And that was 2 days before he drove it to Los Angeles. The day before he got to Los Angeles, I knew the color of the car and the license number, and it was a four-door Chevy. And I never knew how the people knew. Somebody told me my father bought a new car. When he came in, and he saw me in home, and he says, I bought a new car. And I says, before you tell me what it is, I'll tell you what it is. It's a four-door, it's a Chevy, it's green, and license number. And he said, how did you know? I said, somebody yesterday told me, Oh, hi, Fred.
Hi.
I'm in conference right now.
Okay.
Tom? Yeah. Can I answer questions?
Yeah.
When you were young, did you associate mostly with Chinese or non-Chinese?
Mm-hmm. Mostly with Chinese. Like I say, I lived in Chinatown until I was about 18. So it was all with Chinese, and my outside contact is only at school with the Caucasians and Mexicans, and, you know, in high school and in athletics and stuff like that. And but in Chinatown, it's all Chinese.
Did you feel more comfortable with Chinese?
Mm, both. I learned to be comfortable in both, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I am more comfortable in Chinese, I think. I'm more at ease. That's very true.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any disagreements with your father over you being Americanized? Or
no. Never did. He encouraged me to break out. My friends and all his friends have always regarded my father as more of a pioneer, in that my father intermixed with the Caucasian, do business with the Caucasian readily. and most of the other Chinese would not.
Mm-hmm.
And they regard him as more of a pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
And
did your father speak English?
Yes.
Where did he learn his English?
I don't know. That's another question. Apparently, when he came from China, he spoke a little bit of English. He went, like I said, he went to this college that taught herbist medicine. And maybe somewhere along there, or through one of the Christian colleges, he did learn to speak English. I know when he came over, he could speak a little English already. So he must have learned it somewhere in China, and then he developed it out here. But he could speak English quite easy, and he didn't have too much difficulty in the command of English in doing business. My brother helped him a lot in where it got to be more complicated and the, you know, legal jargons and things like that. But my father was always saying that for a Chinese to get along in this American world, you're going to have to learn the American ways of life and still be Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not difficult to be both.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the way he put it to me. So other people regard that as kind of giving in to the American, you know, we had a lot of diehards that are 100% pro-Chinese and never to give in. But in my surrounding, my father encouraged me to go out and meet the Americans and mix with the Americans. And if you're going to do business with them, you have to learn how to be, how to act and behave like they behave. So it wasn't, it was just that he was just telling me the facts of life, that if you're going to be here and you're going to put your roots here, you should at least learn to be a good American, and don't forget you're Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese first, and then, you know, be a business person as an American. So he was never putting down Chinese. He's always proud that, you know, he's from China and he's proud he's Chinese. One thing that was bad, my father didn't become an American citizen until he was in his 50s. For 30 years, he tried to become an American citizen, and all 30 years he was not allowed to be an American citizen. And he constantly wanted to be an American citizen, and after he became an American citizen for about maybe 8 or 9 years, then he died. And it almost seemed like it was futile, you know, it was not worth the demands to be an American citizen. He always wanted to be. And I thought it was real strange, because I said, gee, after all these 30 years, why do you still want to be an American?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Great to be Chinese, at least
mm-hmm.
that's what he told me. But he always wanted to be a citizen of the United States. And it was like two loves. He liked China, and he liked America, but and he got along with the Americans quite well. And
mm-hmm.
it's only because, I guess, in the nature of the business that he was in, he got along, and he subsidized an American by the name of Boyd H. Reynolds, who was one of the leaders in Chinatown in getting Chinese immigrants to become American citizens. He got their immigration papers from them. He was a naturalization immigration expert.
Mm-hmm.
My father subsidized him to immigration school. So when he came out and became an expert in immigrations, he helped my father get a lot of our cousins and relatives into becoming a naturalized citizen. And that was one of the things that my father did do. And Boyd H. Reynolds then opened up an office in Chinatown and did a lot of things for the Chinese that wanted to become getting their final papers in American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But it was real strange. There are families that do not tell their kids to intermix with the American society and to fear them. And my father always thought that was wrong. You don't learn anything by fearing. You actually have to go and meet them head on and then do as good as they do and only know what your weak points are.
So you don't think your father's attitude towards being in the States was typical of most Chinese?
No, I don't think it was. My brother said it wasn't normal. You know, not normal in that, most of them stay a little bit of back away from meeting with the American people. My father was just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed going to restaurants in the American society, and he enjoyed visiting with him. And he always found that that was a lot of fun. Like during the Depression, he and a couple of Americans got together, and he subsidized them in a gold mine in Death Valley. They had a gold mining business in Death Valley.
Uh-huh.
And right then, and they, all during the Depression, they would, these two Caucasian people would dig for gold, and my father would bring the food, and I would drive out in his little Model T to the Death Valley, and they would give him half his share in gold, all during the Depression. And they would take the gold to Jinhing, which is a Jinhing in Chinatown right now. And he was a young man at that time, and then he used to melt this stuff down and pay my father in money for the gold that was refined out of that raw gold.
Mm-hmm.
So my father was always involved in something like that. And then another venture he did with a couple of Caucasians was to go dig for oil in Long Beach.